Hi, counsel, for the appellant, whenever you are ready. Mr. Grimes?
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Terry Grimes and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Carla Delaney, in this action against the Packaging Corporation of America, or PCA. With me here this morning is Melvin Williams from my firm, who will not argue. Also with me is Ann Noel Occhialano from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, who will address the questions that the EOC raised on brief. We have agreed to cede 5 minutes of my time to her. This is a quintessential quid pro quo sexual harassment case decided on summary judgment by the Western District of Virginia, the Roanoke Division. At least that's what it would have been called in the days before Farragher and Ellerth, when the Supreme Court clarified the law to provide that there are three parts to the train, if you will, an engine, a coal car, and a caboose. And if you have harassment by a supervisor or someone with successively higher authority, that would be the engine, and you have a tangible employment action, that'd be the coal car, then the employer is presumptively liable and is not entitled to the Farragher and Ellerth affirmative defense, which I call the caboose of the train, if you will. The district court's first error is that it ignored the fact that the train had an engine. In footnote one, on the second page of the district court's opinion, the district court said it is unnecessary to determine whether Bobby Mills was Carla Delaney's supervisor. A very puzzling statement from the district court. It completely ignores the analysis in Farragher and Ellerth and completely ignores the analysis of this court and, for example, Whitten versus Fred's Inc.
Right, but wasn't the district court saying that if there was no tangible employment action, doesn't matter what Mr. Mills was? And it was, and I understand that, you know, you have further argument as to whether there was a tangible employment action, but wasn't the district court essentially saying, I don't have to go through all those steps if there was no tangible employment action? And why, leaving aside the district court's conclusion on that, why wasn't that a valid methodology?
Because it's...
His end result might have been wrong, but why wasn't that a valid methodology under the Supreme Court case law?
Because that's not what the district court said. What the district court says in footnote one is it is unnecessary to determine whether Bobby Mills is a supervisor. But if the district court,
Well, but I think Judge Keenan's question is a good one. If he is going to assume for purposes of the analysis that the only thing he can assume which would create liability, what's the harm? How does that harm his analysis from your perspective?
If the district court had said, I assume for purposes of argument, or I find as a matter of law, or some such, that Bobby Mills was a supervisor, and I'm therefore moving on to the second point of the analysis, that's an acceptable analysis. That obviously that's an acceptable form of analysis, but that's not what the district court did. If you would like for me to... Obviously, Bobby Mills was a supervisor under Whitten. As a matter of law, I can go through it point by point if you like, or I can move right on to the next point, Judge Duncan. Maybe that's your point, whether there was a TEA. I'll be happy to move there if you want me to move past the supervisor.
I don't want to take up a lot of your time on it. I did have the question arose for me because it was how you started the argument, and I was wondering if you were actually referring to two other things. One, that it seems that the district court was not entirely clear, because at one point in the opinion he refers to Mr. Mills as a co-worker.
Yes.
As a question of fact.
Yes.
And two, if it matters, if you need to find that he is a supervisor for purposes of the defense. But I mean, I've articulated my concern, and you're free to go on with your argument from my perspective.
All right. Thank you very much.
I mean, isn't the real guts of this whether there's a basis for a tangible employment action finding? There certainly was ample evidence from the co-workers that Mr. Mills was the lead person.
Yes.
He was directing the action on the floor. He had all these numerous co-workers in addition to Ms. Delaney gave that testimony. So isn't the real guts of it here the nature of the tangible employment action and its relationship to Mr. Mills' conduct?
To borrow a common phrase, Judge Kennedy, you're preaching to the choir on that point. Yes, the evidence is overwhelming that Bobby Mills was a supervisor. Let me move with the time that I have to the TEA question then. The district court's error here, and once again, it's a remarkable error. On page 8 of the district court's opinion, the district court found that because Carla Delaney did not sign the separation agreement and release of all claims, which was forced upon her, then there was no discharge. And that is, I don't know how to be blunt. Well, let me say it this way. At a minimum, there's a question of fact as to whether there was a discharge. Now listen, obviously a discharge is the quintessential tangible employment action. We all know that. Demotions, discharge, cuts in pay, sometimes even reassignment, those are all the commonly accepted forms of TEAs that have been recognized by many, many courts. Now, my colleague will get to the other question, and that is whether submission is in and of itself a TEA. But I'll address the more mundane and more common forms of TEA, if you will, and that is whether there was a discharge.
Right. It doesn't really matter on the submission if we find that she sufficiently pleaded a case of termination, right?
Yes.
Based on Mr. Yes. Mills's conduct.
Yes.
I mean, the submission is an independent basis.
Yes.
And what is the substantial evidence that you contend the district court overlooked in concluding as a matter of law that no reasonable jury could find she was terminated or discharged? Have I correctly stated, framed the issue?
Is there evidence that she was discharged?
No. Substantial evidence? She has the burden of proof, right?
Oh, yes.
Of course. So it's not just, is there evidence that there was a termination? The question is, in summary judgment, is there evidence on the basis of which a reasonable fact finder could conclude by a preponderance of the evidence yes. that she was discharged?
Yes, here it is.
Okay.
JA 319, this is the colloquy. Question to Ms. Delaney. When you were handed that document, talking about the severance agreement that was forced upon her, the release of all claims, by the HR manager of the company, in the presence of the plant manager and with the other manager, Mike Bourne, who was present, when you were handed that document, were you told what would happen if you didn't sign the document today? Answer, yes. Question, what were you told? Answer, that I would be fired. Question, did Mr. Bright, he was the HR manager, take the lead, if you will, in that conversation with you, or was everybody speaking? Answer, everybody was speaking. They triple-teamed her, tried to get her to release all claims, and she wouldn't sign it. I don't know whether a light bulb went off her head and what, but it doesn't matter. She didn't sign the document. And then let's look at what happened next, Judge Duncan. Mike Bourne walked her...
That would be Judge Davis.
Judge Davis, my apologies.
That's okay.
My apology. Mike Bourne walked through the plant, took her to her locker, said, get your stuff out of your locker. We're taking your lock. We're taking your key. We're taking that little plastic swipe card that you use to get in and out of the building and start your time clock. Get all of your things, and we're taking you to the door. And she never entered that plant again. Now, I concede that several days later, the company sent a letter to her saying, by the by, you weren't actually fired the other day. All right? So at most, what does that do? It creates a question of fact. But we have two additional pieces of evidence while I'm on this particular point. PCA sent an email dated November 5, 2007 in the joint appendix at page 187 that said Delaney's employment status was terminated. And then PCA told the Virginia Employment Commission in the joint appendix at page 189 that Delaney was discharged. So...
And that November 5th memo explains that her payroll was stopped as of the date the separation agreement is prepared?
I think it did, Your Honor, yes. And let's look at it another way, because we get the inferences here. Every day your employer could send you a letter saying, You're not fired today. You're not fired today. But if you're fired, it gets an inference. They're doing something. They're covering their tracks, if you will. Now, that's just an inference. That's not a hard fact. I concede that. But it is odd that after they tell you to clean out your locker, take your books and your papers, take all of your stuff, give us your key, give us your plastic card that gets you in and out of the building, and here's the door, a jury could find that she was discharged. And that's the first TEA, all right? And if the court agrees with us on that point, this case goes back for remand and retrial. I submit the evidence is almost as strong as in that point, but I leave to your discretion whether you reach that conclusion or not. All right, so I'm already at my yellow light. So I'll address just briefly the caboose, the caboose, if you will, and that is, what did the company do? And I'm not going to have a lot of time to do this. The company have a sexual harassment policy? And the answer is yes. But here's what they did. You can't rely on any documents the company prepares for this reason. Look at JA 80 and 81. On January 5, 2007, they had her sign a acknowledgement of an EEO policy.
Does it matter for purposes of the defense if there's a tangible and adverse employment action?
No.
Okay.
No. The answer is no. Much of the focus of the defense is on what a swell caboose we have, all right? If you got the engine, you got the coal car, the train runs just fine, you don't need the caboose. I'm going to now sit down, unless you have any specific questions, and ask my colleague to take the podium.
Good morning. May it please the court, Ann Noel Occolino for the EEOC as amicus. Although we didn't weigh in on this issue, I want to address this court's questions about whether it matters for purposes of analysis if Mills was a supervisor, if there wasn't a tangible employment action. And I think you suggested that maybe it wouldn't matter. I'd just like to say that I think it probably still does matter, because even without a tangible employment action, I think the standard for harassment liability is a little bit different. For a coworker, it's a negligent standard, but for supervisor, it's an affirmative defense, so the burden would be on the employer. So I just forward that the commission thinks that there is still a difference and it would matter. And again, I won't waste my time on whether Mills was a supervisor. You seem to agree that there's at least a factual question about that. The issues that the commission wanted to address are whether a tangible employment action occurred in this case. And we did not address whether the termination was a tangible employment action, but we argued that three other actions were tangible employment actions.
You have no problem, though, with Mr. Grimes' analysis regarding a tangible employment action, do you? Termination?
You know, the commission just didn't weigh in.
You're just not taking a stand.
We're not taking a position. I'm not trying to be evasive, Your Honor. But we think that two of them were very clear, and one tangible employment action is that she was sent home without pay. And it's not just Carla Delaney who testified that she had been sent home without pay, but it's also Mr. Mills, and that's in the joint appendix at page 356, which is his deposition, where he talks about an incident where she was failing to cooperate with him, and he said, well, you can take yourself on home. Her attorney said, did she lose pay? And Mr. Mills said, yes. So in the commission's view, anytime an employer inflicts direct economic injury through the supervisor, that's a tangible employment action.
But the assessment of points isn't necessarily under our authority, because each point is not itself determinative.
It's not determinative, but in the commission's view, it still is a tangible employment action, even if you separate it out.
I understand, but it's a tougher argument.
It's a more difficult argument, and also
you don't really need that.
You don't need it, right. Because my favorite argument in this case is that the tangible employment action that occurred here, the most egregious one, was requiring Ms. Delaney to have sex about once a week to keep her job. In the commission's view, that is a tangible employment action under Ellerth. There, the court said that a significant change in employment status is a tangible employment action. And the court explained that such an action is the means by which the supervisor brings the official power of the company to bear on subordinates. The court also explained that only a supervisor can impose a tangible employment action. For instance, both a supervisor and a coworker could have broken Ms. Delaney's arm, but only a supervisor could dock her pay. Only a supervisor could threaten, for instance, similarly, to fire her or to assign her points if she refused to engage in sex. So we think that there's something more than the mere existence of the employment relationship here that enabled the harassment. It's because Mr. Mills was imbued with authority by the company that he was able to coerce Ms. Delaney into having sex with him. And the specific actions in this case really illustrate that point. Her coworker testified that Mr. Mills would page her on the intercom, and she would have to leave her station where she was helping to glue the boxes together to go to the office, and that's where he would assault her. And she also testifies, I think quite poignantly in her deposition, she said that the assaults would occur in the men's bathroom of the supervisor's office, and she was asked, well, how did Mr. Mills know that he wouldn't be interrupted? And she testified that he had a key. So it's with the key given him by the company to access the supervisor's office, he was able to carry out his assaults. And it's true that it doesn't inflict an economic injury, and Ellerth and Farragher said a tangible employment action usually would. But certainly here she experienced emotional, and sometimes plaintiffs could experience a physical injury through that kind of action. It's also true that this action wasn't recorded in the company records, as the company has argued, but that can't be the sine qua non of a tangible employment action, because not every tangible employment action would be in the records. For instance, a failure to promote or a failure to give a pay raise might be something that is not necessarily recorded in the company's records, and therefore a higher up wouldn't have an opportunity to review it. Similarly, the company has argued against our approach because it says that here the status quo was maintained. Nothing changed for Ms. Delaney. Well, we disagree with that, but legally it's also wrong because the status quo is also maintained when a woman is not given a raise or not given a promotion, but we can all agree that those are tangible employment actions. And the employer also argues here that there's an improper focus on the employee's reaction as opposed to the harasser's action, but I respectfully have to disagree. Everything focuses on what the supervisor does. If the supervisor threatens a woman with termination if she doesn't have sex and he carries through and he fires her with the power given to him by the company, I see my time is up, but could I finish my thought?
If you could finish your sentence.
Then he's carried out his action and there's a tangible employment action. If he threatens her and she complies and has sex and he engages in that act of having sex, which he does with the authority given to him by the company, vicarious liability, tangible employment action. But if he doesn't fulfill the threat, then it's just a hostile work environment and he can, the company has affirmative defense. Thank you.
Mr. Postol.
Good morning, Your Honors. If I can address the termination. First of all, she was given a letter, as the judge found. The letter said you have 21 days to consider, 7 days to revoke. The testimony was that she was told, they said, if you want us to fax it to your lawyer, we'll be happy to fax it to your lawyer. She admitted that she was not told that she was fired. That's at the Joint Appendix, page 67. She assumed she was fired because they walked her out. The reason why they did that is her whole thing was, I wanted to go home but be paid, so they assumed she wasn't going to come back.
Why isn't this a jury issue, though? I mean, the employee is escorted out of the building. All ability to get back into the building is removed from her. Why isn't this an issue of fact for the jury? Do they believe her, that her employment was terminated, or do they believe the company?
Well, because I think the judge found as a matter of law, when the document says, the very document you're relying on for your termination says you're not fired,
but
it says
you're... internal documents indicated that she was terminated.
Only if she accepted the agreement.
If the manager of a company that I worked for escorted me to my desk, made me pick up my belongings and my key to re-enter and escorted me out the door, I would assume that I was fired, and I don't think that would necessarily be an unreasonable assumption.
Well, it depends on the circumstances.
Exactly, but that's why it's a question of fact. The assertion that she was not terminated didn't come until after the fact that she was escorted out the door.
Well, I don't think so, because put it in perspective. Her discussion with the manager was, I have 21 days to consider this. I want to be paid while I'm home considering it. So she was the one who basically said, I want to go home.
But she was told that she would be fired if she didn't sign it, and she didn't sign it.
Well,
according to her testimony.
Well, one testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but then when she specifically asked, did you say you were fired?
Those are credibility issues for jury.
Well, but
haven't you given inconsistent statements on this? But there is testimony that she said, they told me I'd be fired. If I didn't sign it, I didn't sign it. Why isn't it logical then to conclude, or why couldn't a jury conclude she was fired?
Well,
given the fact she was hustled out of the building, all of her incidents of employment were stripped from her?
Sure. I think because, one, the document says you have 21 days to consider, and two, they sent a letter 2 days later because they didn't even realize that's what she thought until she came back 2 days. She wasn't forced out of the building. She actually came back to turn in her uniform, and I believe at that point was to turn in her keys, and they said, we want to talk to you. And she refused to talk to them.
It would be a very dangerous rule, it seems to me, if this court were to permit district judges to give controlling, conclusive weight as a matter of law to a document prepared by a company that contradicts what is really going on the ground. I mean, that's what you're essentially asking us to do. The document says, oh, you can consult an attorney, you have 4 weeks to look to think this over. At the same time, she's being escorted out of the building, her access is being denied, her locker's being cleaned out.
I understand, but at her request, she said, I want to go home and be paid while I consider this.
She asked to be escorted out of the building, as I recall, and her access to the building removed.
Well, she said that she wanted to be home and be paid. To
right,
me, the same thing.
But no, it really isn't even remotely the same thing. It doesn't seem, I don't help your argument to ignore that there are inconsistencies there, and it is precisely those inconsistencies that would seem to me to make it a triable issue of fact for the jury. The juries may agree with you that dispositive weight is to be given to the document, but juries may not agree that being escorted out of a building is not tantamount to firing.
Well, I understand that, and all I can say is they sent a letter where they tried to talk to her when she came back. She clearly knew to come back, and they then, in fact, when she refused to talk to them, sent a letter. But can I point out something else? I hate to say this, but I don't think it matters, because the whole point of having a tangible employment action is that the harassing supervisor did something and that the company was therefore on notice and they didn't take action. The problem here is Mills didn't fire her. It was somebody else. It was after she raised the issue and they took prompt action. So even if you find that she was fired,
still that causal link, because if the jury believes her, because she was then fired, why couldn't the jury believe that she was fired? Because she refused to sign the separation agreement, which attempted to wipe out all the company's liability for Mills' harassing action.
And that would make it a retaliation claim, which the judge, she didn't even fight the summary judgment on that, and they didn't raise an appeal. So that because it's not by Mills, and because it's after they did their investigation, it can't qualify as a tangible employment action. And Your Honor is correct. It could actually be retaliation.
Right, but the case law in Ellis talks about culminating in a tangible employment action. So that doesn't require that the actual actor terminating be the person who caused the problem.
I think it does,
Your Honor. It talks about culminating. Doesn't that suggest a causal relationship rather than immediate actor to victim?
Not when you put it in perspective, because remember what the framework is. If we're going to make an employer liable and we're not going to give them the option of having a sexual harassment policy, having notice, then we're going to stick it to them if, in fact, they had notice that the harasser was using company official action. So if it's not by the harasser, then how can it fit into the Supreme Court?
Well, they certainly had notice by the time they fired Mr. Mills, and what did they do?
Sure,
according to Ms. Delaney, they fired her too.
Yeah,
so why wouldn't that certainly be noticed? They knew all about what Mills was about. They were so disgusted with what he did, they showed him the door, and then they proceed to fire her.
Yeah, but and that's my point. At that point, they have met the affirmative defense. They took prompt action.
So they can fire her because she was a victim, you're saying, just so long as they took prompt action against him.
No. Then it would be retaliation. But she didn't raise retaliation. Your Honor, you are correct. We can't fire her. But it's not because it's a tangible employment action. It's because it would be retaliation.
Is it your position? I'm trying to understand how you're parsing this.
Yes.
Is it your position that that the adverse employment, the tangible employment action has to be taken by the harasser?
Yes, and before you take prompt action.
And what is your authority for that proposition?
The Supreme Court basically saying that we're doing this because
That's your interpretation of Ellis, because I don't think there's anything in the language
I think it comes up on the submission cases where the Judge Brown in the D.C. Circuit Court case, Lufner versus Gonzalez, basically went through the whole analysis and said, hey, the reason why the submission cases don't work is because the whole idea of a tangible employment action is that you're putting the employer, the employer's on notice, at least constructive notice, that their supervisor is taking this act, and therefore we're going to hold them liable for it, even though the employee didn't use a sexual harassment policy. I mean, remember, this is a company that as soon they had a policy, you could call a number in Chicago headquarters, you could call HR, you could call the general manager, and for 9 months, this woman never said boo to them. And well, I take that back. She said, she came in and complained to Mills, to Supervisor Bourne, that by the way, he's spreading a rumor that I have a sexual disease. But she didn't bother saying, oh, by the way, he's also forcing me to have sex. So we're in a position.
Great jury argument.
Well, yeah, but
it really is. Maybe a jury wouldn't believe her. Maybe they would think that nobody would engage in this kind of conduct.
But what the Supreme Court is saying is if the only time we're going to not take away that defense from you, which we clearly established here, that we took prompt action, you couldn't be more prompt, you couldn't be more effective. We showed Mills the door. And so the Supreme Court is saying, look, we're going to take that away if the harasser already took action against the company, because then you were on notice. But once you've already taken the action, it doesn't matter that later on there's other notice because you've already taken the action. It does matter for retaliation. I agree with Your Honor there. But it doesn't matter for on the Supreme Court taking away a defense that they've established. It was a weighing. They said, look, we're going to establish this defense, but we're going to take it away if you let the harasser take an adverse action because it has to be a significant, and the wording is significant change in employment status. And that's why the points, and even if she missed a few hours of pay, don't become significant. If I move on to the submissions, unless you...
Does that work with respect to her being sent home and her pay docked?
Yes, because it has to be a significant change in employment status. And it was the Second Circuit in Martyr versus Castro who said losing a little pay doesn't matter. I mean, literally, we're talking less than $50 here probably. In fact, we don't even know, because what she said is, I'd argue with Mills, I would go home early, and she didn't get docked for points. What happened was she would leave on her own. She said it happened two or three times. This is at Joint Appendix 324. And then she would get points because she said two or three times, I either left my workstation or I went home. Well, if she left the workstation, she wouldn't even be docked pay. She'd just get points. And so, but we don't even know whether it was $10 she lost or $20. There's no evidence that it was significant. And remember, a significant change in employment status. I mean, the EEOC, I mean, they apparently don't like the affirmative defense. So they would like to get rid of it by saying any change at all counts and sort of ignore the Supreme Court's word significant.
Well, I thought it was tangible employment action.
But then they go on to define tangible employment action as, quote, a significant change in employment status. That's the Supreme Court's word in words in Eller. So tangible employment action is a significant change in employment status. And then, of course, they give the examples, firing, loss of promotion. And again, it's all based on that this is some official conduct that the employer would have constructive notice on. And so you're trying to take away our policy, our defense, and the Supreme Court says, well, we're only going to do that if you were on notice and there was a significant change.
But it seems to me that we don't know how much money she lost, and perhaps that is something you could argue to the jury. We're having to infer as a matter of law, you're asking us to infer as a matter of law, that it was not in a substantial effect to her, which it could well have been.
Well, but she's made no effort to prove it. In fact, there's very little testimony on it. They didn't develop in the record. They didn't brief it to the judge. The only time they even raised it was at oral argument. And even then, they had it backwards. They said she got points and was dock pay. It was actually the reverse. She didn't get dock pay except for going home. So,
but for it is significant for purposes of your defense.
Yes, but how can you say being sent home? I mean, she made I think it was $12 an hour. So, and she doesn't. So it's two or three times. She doesn't even say which times she left the station, which there'd be no docking. There's nothing that suggests it's significant. This court's precedent talks about, if you give them bad assignments, that's not a significant change.
It's not an economic impact either. It's not a loss of money.
Well, I'll tell you this. I'd rather have the better assignments and lose a little pay, but
I suspect you're at a higher pay grade.
Probably correct, Your Honor. But I think that would be true of even most people. So I don't think under this court's precedence, being sent home, her going home early two or three times would meet the definition of significant. On the submission, because I don't want to forget it, we rely basically on Judge Brown, who I think went through a very good analysis on why this is crazy. It's not adverse. It's not a change in employment.
How can you say it's not adverse? My goodness.
I'm sorry. That is
a grading.
Well, yes, but it's not adverse employment action. And I'm sorry. In fact, I mixed it up.
You've got to do this or you'll lose your job. And here you have somebody who, is of a low education level who might actually believe that she's got to do this.
I understand that. And if you believe her evidence, you are absolutely correct.
Which we have to do.
Yes. And we've never fought on summary judgment. We didn't fight over, that it was sexual harassment, that it was adverse.
You did make a number of remarks in your brief casting aspersions on her personally and suggesting that she was to be disbelieved because she may have been a stripper.
Well, no, it was more than that, Your Honor. It was...
Regardless.
Yes.
It can only be a credibility issue.
Well, I think the judge can weigh it somewhat in deciding whether
No, judge cannot weigh evidence in a Rule 56 proceeding. You see, that's the problem.
Well, he can find that no reasonable jury could find something.
That's not weighing the evidence.
Fair enough, Your Honor. But I guess my problem was that it just seemed like a strange...
You think she is undeserving of belief or credibility?
Well, yes, but that's not the issue here. I certainly agree with that.
It certainly can't be on summary judgment.
I agree on that. But I guess my problem with the submission is also it's totally waived. It wasn't raised below. It's not a fundamental error. The cases they cite for fundamental error are that you ignored a Supreme Court precedent. That would be bad. Or you tried the case totally on the wrong theory. And submission is obviously neither of those. In fact, whether submission is actually a valid defense is the courts are split on it. So we think with that, it's waived. And again, I think we need to put it in perspective of we've proved and I don't think there could be much doubt that we acted promptly, we had a good policy, and I understand what happened to her was terrible, but on the other hand, why she didn't complain for 9 months and I can understand I'm afraid, but she went and complained that he was spreading a rumor that she had a sexual disease. So why complain on that?
Maybe she thought that would get him fired, and she'd be done with him.
Yeah, but and I Sam, but when the supervisor, according to her, said, "Well, that's just a rumor," why not say, "And by the way, he's also doing this"? I mean, I mean, the whole idea of having a policy.
I can imagine lots of employers who would take serious disciplinary action against a supervisor under circumstances where a subordinate comes to his supervisor and reports that he's spreading rumors that someone has a subordinate has a sexually transmitted disease.
Yeah, well,
that's a pretty serious.
Yeah, charge. Well, in fact, our testimony was she never actually reported it. But if you believe her,
which makes it a jury question.
Well, no, because I'm willing to believe her for purposes of motion that she made that statement.
Okay.
So, but then it becomes. Okay, then why didn't you follow the policy? I mean, frankly, what happened to her is terrible, but the whole idea of the sexual harassment policy isn't just to protect that person, it's to protect all the women. And part of the trouble is, if you don't report it, then it could go on for other people. That's why the Supreme Court had the balancing of, if you have a policy, and you diligently enforce it and you take prompt action, we're not going to stick you with a liability unless the harasser, you're basically on such notice that you should have known, and therefore we're going to attach a liability to you.
If we remand this case, what is your understanding of the posture in which it will come back to the district court? Because the district court didn't deal with this supervisor issue, and my sense is, if this case goes back, I'm not predicting what's going to happen with this panel, but if it goes back, I mean, you're stuck with that, aren't you?
Stuck with it? You didn't deal with it?
That the case goes forward on the assumption that he's a supervisor.
I don't think that, because...
Why don't you think that? In other words...
Because he didn't make a finding that he's a supervisor.
Well, you didn't urge the court to make that finding. Don't you see? If the district court thinks it can dispose of the case, assuming certain facts in favor of the plaintiff and declining to resolve them as a matter of law, it seems to me if this case goes back, under the law of the case, he's a supervisor for purposes of, not as a matter of law in front of the jury, but as a matter of law in terms of what the judge can do with the case, he's a supervisor.
Well, I, if you're trying to say we can't go for summary judgment on that issue,
that's what I'm suggesting, right? I don't think you can file a second summary judgment motion. That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm not determining what the district judge can do.
I can make it easier on it. That would not be an issue I would file summary judgment on. I would have to agree that's a fact issue.
Okay.
You don't have to worry about that.
Okay.
But I prefer you not send it back. I've got to say this about the district judge. He went through this in a very orderly, thorough manner. I mean, when you went through his opinion, he addressed all these, and he even addressed the points when it wasn't even raised in the brief. So it's not like he didn't go through each step. And, you know, I don't see how the termination afterwards, it could be retaliation, but how it could be what the Supreme Court was looking for as a tangible event to take away the affirmative defense.
You're saying they're mutually exclusive propositions. Do you have any authority for that?
I'm not saying they're always mutually exclusive. I'm saying when, in fact, it happened, not by the harasser, and after you took the prompt action, it can't take away the defense.
Doesn't it come down to what the language in Ellerth means when it talks culminating in termination?
Not just the language, also what they're trying to do there, the balance they're trying to strike. And I think what they were saying is, if the official took the action and you're stuck with it, you can't remedy it. But we had already remedied the situation. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Grimes.
I think as an initial matter, it would be helpful if you answer Mr. Postol's argument that you did not preserve the submission argument in the district court. Do you please address that?
Yes, Your Honor. Our position is that we've said all along, and in summary judgment below, this is a quid pro quo sexual harassment case, and that every submission case is quid pro quo. I concede. We did not articulate the specific argument that a submission case is a TEA as clearly as we could have. We have said what we said, and I stand on it. And maybe the shorthand is every quid pro quo case is submission. It just is. Second, I've made a plain error argument on brief, and I won't say anything further about that. But that's my response, Judge Keenan. Now, briefly, my opponent has made a fundamental misstatement of law, which I must correct. My opponent said that there is no TEA unless the action is taken by Bobby Mills. Wrong, wrong, wrong. Here's what the Supreme Court said in Farragher and Ellerth. Just reading from the opinion. If the harassment by a supervisor results in a tangible employment action, then the presumption that the employer is vicariously liable is conclusive. The employer is not entitled to assert an affirmative defense. Now, here's the magic words. Moreover, it is liable for the entire course of conduct, not just the conduct resulting in the tangible action. That's why this retaliation argument is a red herring by my opponent. as to whether the plaintiff complained or not. She complained when she complained. She was told if she would complain, she'd be fired. So a reasonable person may find that's why she didn't complain until she did. But also I point out to you in conclusion that neither plaintiff in Farragher or Ellerth ever complained. Never complained. And the Supreme Court remanded both of those cases for further consideration. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
We will ask the clerk to adjourn court for today and come down and greet counsel.